for you and others might not. I physically feel shame in, on, my. It feels like. I know I'm in shame when I feel. If I could taste shame, it would taste like. If I could smell shame, it would smell like. If I could touch shame, it would feel like. Recognizing shame is an important tool for regaining our power. For example, I know that I need to be alone for at least 15 or 20 minutes when I'm experiencing shame. Now that I recognize the physical symptoms, I often use those as a cue to make a quick exit. Once I'm alone, I can feel my feelings in private. I can cry or take deep breaths. Most of the women I interviewed talked about the importance of being alone for a few minutes so they could pull themselves together or sort through their feelings. I also had women tell me they liked to jog or go for walks or be outside. When we know how shame feels, we have an important resilience tool. Often we feel shame before we think it. Recognizing our shame allows us to find the space we need to process the experience and gain some clarity before we act out or shut down. The next step in examining our experiences is to better understand our shame triggers. Shame triggers. When I first began my research, one of my goals was to develop a list of shame triggers. My thinking was pretty simple. If we knew what issues triggered shame, we could stay alert and, if not avoid them, at least increase our awareness about the potential of experiencing shame. Of course, it didn't take long to learn that shame is a highly individualized experience, and there are no universal shame triggers. Along with other researchers, I found that the issues and experiences that trigger shame appear to be as individual and different as women, their relationships, and their cultures. I also learned that we face shame every day, no matter how well we recognize our triggers. Avoiding shame is not possible. However, as I spoke to women, I saw a very strong pattern emerge in the interviews. Women with high levels of shame resilience recognize shame and understand their shame triggers. When women with high shame resilience talked about their shame, they clearly knew what triggered it and why some issues were greater triggers than others. Recognizing and understanding our triggers is not something that we instinctively know how to do. It's a process. Sylvia's story is a great example of this first element of resilience in action. Sylvia, an event planner in her 30s, jumped right into our interview by saying, "I wish you could have interviewed me 6 months ago. I was a different person. I was so stuck in shame." When I asked her what she meant, she explained that she had heard about my research from a friend and volunteered to be interviewed because she felt her life had been changed by shame. She had recently had an important breakthrough. Sylvia said her breakthrough happened when she found herself on the losers list at work. Apparently, after 2 years of what her employer called outstanding winner's work, she had made her first big mistake. The mistake cost her agency a major client. Her boss's response was to put her on the losers list. She said, "In 1 minute, I went from being on the winner's board to being on top of the losers list." I guess I must have winced when Sylvia referred to the losers list, because without my remarking at all, she said, "I know, it's terrible. My boss has big dry erase boards outside of his office. One's the winners list, and one board is for the losers." She said for weeks she could barely function. She lost her confidence and started missing work. Shame, anxiety, and fear took over. Then one evening, Sylvia was talking to her sister about the loser board, and it all started to make sense. Sylvia and her sister had been very competitive athletes in high school. Sylvia had even been offered a scholarship but turned it down. As Sylvia and her sister talked, her sister reminded Sylvia about their father's constant use of the word loser. "No one likes a loser. Losers never change." He would post their track times on the refrigerator door, along with sticky notes that said things like, "Be a winner." Sylvia said, I got off the phone with my sister, cried, and started working on my resume. I realized that I couldn't work there anymore. It's not just the word loser that throws me into shame. It's the whole idea of believing that you're either good or bad. You can't be good and have a bad day or make a bad decision. You can't be a good runner and run a bad race. I'm embarrassed, or I guess it's really ashamed that I used to be like that. I laughed at the people on the losers list until I was on it. I made fun of the losers just like my dad and my boss. I regret not competing in college. I could have gone to a better school with the scholarship. Now I know I didn't go because I wouldn't have always been a winner with that level of competition. Now I'm afraid of being less than perfect, and my sister is still struggling with an eating disorder. That's how bad it was to be a loser in my family. Sylvia later told me that she and her sister made a pact to call each other whenever they felt what they called loser shame. Does this mean that Sylvia is no longer vulnerable to feeling shame around failing or being cast as a loser? Absolutely not. No level of shame resilience provides us with immunity. What it means is that Sylvia will have much more awareness about what she's feeling when it happens again. This process gives her better tools to step back and think about what happened and why it happened. Then she can start to work her way out of it, constructively. Unwanted identities. To start the process of recognizing our shame triggers, we need to look at the concept of unwanted identities. Over the course of interviews, 12 categories emerged as areas in which women struggle the most with feelings of shame. These categories are appearance and body image, motherhood, family, parenting, money and work, mental and physical health, sex, aging, religion, being stereotyped and labeled, speaking out, and surviving trauma. What makes us vulnerable to shame in these areas are the unwanted identities associated with each of these topics. For example, many women used adjectives like loudmouth and pushy to describe unwanted identities associated with speaking out. These specific unwanted identities surfaced in the interviews as women described the difficulty of navigating all of the messages and stereotypes that discourage them from taking an unpopular stand on an issue, or sharing opinions that might make others feel uncomfortable. Researchers Tamara Ferguson, Heidi Ayer, and Michael Ashbaker argue that unwanted identity is the quintessential elicitor of shame. They explain that unwanted identities are characteristics that undermine our vision of our ideal selves. Sometimes we perceive others as assigning these unwanted identities to us, and other times we pin them on ourselves. For example, I don't think any of us would ideally describe ourselves as pushy loudmouths, nor would we want others to describe us this way. These hurtful stereotypes are often used, successfully I might add, to keep women quiet. We don't even have to be pushy or boisterous to fear these labels. It's been socialized in us. So where do unwanted identities come from? The messages and stereotypes that are the most powerful are those that we learned from our families of origin. The term family of origin refers to the family in which we were reared. In my interviews with both men and women, it was obvious that many of the unwanted identities that cause us to feel shame stem from messages we heard growing up and the stereotypes we were taught by our parents or immediate caregivers. Sometimes teachers, clergy, and other important adults in our lives may have helped shape our thinking. However, parents and caregivers are by far the most influential. I would venture to say that when it comes to the 12 shame categories, every family has identities they value and, likewise, unwanted identities that are seen as shameful, unacceptable, or unworthy. For example, in my family, being sick was an unwanted identity. We never really talked about illness. I never heard my parents say anything negative about sickness or health issues. However, I grew up believing that illness was weakness. Interestingly, my parents didn't shame us for being sick, and they were empathic and helpful with neighbors or family members who were sick. However, they were both hard on themselves when they got sick, which was rare, When they were sick, they toughed it out. They didn't slow down. If they had surgery, they were back on carpool duty or back at work right away. So if you combine this upbringing with a culture that despises the sick, you can see how being sick became a powerful, unwanted identity for me. This was never a problem until I became very ill when I was pregnant. Not only did I get sick, I was diagnosed with hyperemesis gravidarum, a pregnancy-related condition characterized by extreme nausea, vomiting, and dehydration. So there I was, throwing up 25 times a day, unable to keep down ice chips, hospitalized for severe dehydration, and spending what little energy I had trying to figure out if any of the hospital rooms had internet access, or if maybe Steve could videotape me teaching from my bed. That way the dean wouldn't need to bring in another instructor to take over my class. I kept telling Steve, "This can't be happening. I'm tough. I don't get sick." Finally, out of frustration, he lovingly held my face in his hands and said, "Well, apparently you do get sick. And right now, you're not so tough. You're human like the rest of us. You really need to work through this. You're not going back to work for a couple of months. This is serious. You need to apply some of your own shame medicine right now." Family messages die hard, and many times, they're very insidious. The messages become part of the fabric of our families. Until we can recognize and understand why and how they influence our lives, we just keep living by them and passing them down to the next generation. I don't believe my parents consciously introduced the messages about illness and weakness to our family. In fact, as I get older, I'm able to look back with more clarity and perspective. I'm sure they were also prisoners of this message. Both my parents were raised in families where these beliefs about toughness and weakness seemed to be encoded in the genes. I think, if anything, they just unknowingly passed them along. I've had to work very hard to break the cycle with my children. And as my experiences demonstrate, it doesn't have anything to do with what I say or how I treat others. I have to watch what I do and how I treat myself when I'm feeling sick. Being married to a very compassionate physician helps. He often reminds me that being tough is more about being lucky, that when illness strikes, toughness has nothing to do with it. We're all vulnerable. Of course, families don't operate in a vacuum. Like individuals, they are influenced by the culture and history. I interviewed Deidre, a woman in her 60s, who told me that she had spent years being shamed by her mother about money and indulgent behavior. Deidre described her house as nice, but not over the top. Yet when her mother would come and visit, she would walk through the house picking up things and saying, "Look at this place. Who do you think you are? A queen of Sheba? All you do is spend, spend, spend. You've spoiled your kids rotten, and you live like there's no tomorrow. I can't believe you're my child." Deidre's mother was a child of the Depression. For her, any material possession that wasn't a necessity was extravagant and wasteful. And both extravagance and wastefulness were major unwanted identities that she used to shame her daughter. In addition to the messages and stereotypes passed down through our families of origin, we also live in a world with partners, colleagues, friends, and community members, where TV and magazines do nothing but set expectations and define what is and what is not acceptable. I don't want to dismiss the important role that all of these factors play in our lives. However, in my research, it was painfully clear that the shaming wounds inflicted in our first families often set the stage for many of our greatest shame struggles. I've been asked many times if I think that shame can only be experienced in areas where we have been shamed by our parents or caregivers, but I don't think this is the case. I do believe we are more vulnerable to shame triggers that developed from our families of origin. However, I interviewed many people who struggle with shame around issues that stem from other places, namely cultural messages and stereotypes. This is especially true of women and men who are under 40. For many people in this age group, the media has become the primary storyteller in their lives. Along with their families, TV is now setting the expectations and defining the unwanted identities. The strength of vulnerability. When I first started writing on shame, I actually referred to this element of shame resilience as acknowledging our vulnerabilities rather than understanding our shame triggers. I changed it for a couple of reasons. First, over the past 2 years, I've received hundreds of letters and emails from people who are applying the strategies that are outlined in this book to build shame resilience. In the vast majority of these letters, people write about the power of discovering their shame triggers. In many ways, I think the term shame trigger just rings truer for people than the term acknowledging vulnerability. Second, I think people still struggle with the term vulnerability. We equate vulnerability with weakness, and in our culture, there are very few things we abhor more than weakness. Regardless of the words we choose, recognizing and understanding our triggers is essentially the same as recognizing and understanding our vulnerabilities, and this is a source of strength. Vulnerability is not weakness. Sometimes we are afraid that acknowledging that something exists is going to make it worse. For example, if I acknowledge that being perceived as a good mother is really important, and if I accept the fact that motherhood is a vulnerable issue for me, is the shame around this issue going to grow? No, this is simply not true. When we feel shame about an experience, we often feel some overwhelming combination of confusion, fear, and judgment. If it happens in an area where we know we're vulnerable, we're much more likely to come out of this confusion, fear, and judgment with an instinct about what we're feeling and what we need to do to find support. Again, my cookie appropriation story provides a good example. I want to be a good mother, and I want to be perceived as a good mother. So when someone says something to me, or when I do feel something that threatens my good mom status, my shame is triggered. I'm not surprised when I'm overcome by feelings of shame around this issue. I may still feel pain, confusion, fear, and judgment, but I have just enough information to react a little more quickly than I would if it were an area of acknowledged vulnerability, like if I didn't know that motherhood was a shame trigger for me. When we experience shame, we often feel confused, fearful, and judged. This makes it very difficult to access the awareness we need to evaluate our choices. We're in a fog. That's how shame makes us powerless. After my exchange with Ellen's teacher, I knew I needed to talk to someone in my connection network, but it was still a difficult call to make. Here's how 4 other women described the importance of recognizing their triggers, or acknowledging their vulnerabilities. I only see my therapist 3 or 4 times a year, 1 time after each trip to visit my parents. I know they love me, but I also know they use shame and judge me about being fat and unmarried. I make the trips for all of us, but I see my therapist afterward for myself. If there's one thing I've learned, it's never to bring up money around my mother-in-law. If she starts worrying about me and my husband, she starts shaming us about buying too much. It took me several years to learn that, but it makes a big difference. We don't fight, and I don't avoid her like the plague. In my 2nd year of fertility problems, I finally accepted the fact that I couldn't go to baby showers. When you're in your early 30s, it seems like there's a baby shower every weekend. I found myself going and making an ass out of myself. I would talk about how great it was to have the freedom and flexibility of not having kids. I'd ask stupid questions about the horrors of labor. The only person who knew we were trying to get pregnant was my best friend. After 1 particularly bad shower, she confronted me. She said I was being mean and not like myself. She asked me if it was about the fertility problems. When I realized it was, I had a total breakdown. She helped me through it. She also helped me understand that it was okay to not go to all the showers. A few years after my husband died, I started going out with a gentleman from our Domino's Club. About 6 months after we started spending time together, I asked my daughter if I could talk to her about sex. I wasn't looking for the birds and bees conversation. Certainly her existence would prove that I knew how things worked. She's a health teacher at a junior high school, and I had heard her talking about AIDS. Well, my friend had a blood transfusion some years back, and I wanted to know about the risks. When I sat down with her and started explaining my question, she said, "You've got to be kidding me, Mother. That's disgusting. I don't ever want to talk about that again." I was completely mortified. I said, "What do you mean, disgusting?" She told me that I was disgusting for even thinking about having sex with someone at my age. Up until that minute, I didn't think much about it. I thought it was natural. I thought it was good that I was asking the right questions. When she said that to me, when she called me disgusting, it was so belittling. I completely lost my confidence. I regressed, you could say. I thought to myself, what am I thinking? What am I doing? But I know my daughter can really get me stirred up. She can act very holier-than-thou like her father. Luckily, I have some very dear friends. I talked to them, and they helped me make sense of it. I went right along with my plans, but I keep her out of it. I guess you could say we have a don't-ask-don't-tell policy. It's not just shame resilience that is increased when we acknowledge our vulnerabilities. Several other fields of study, including health psychology and social psychology, have produced very persuasive evidence on the importance of acknowledging vulnerabilities. From the field of health psychology, studies show that perceived vulnerability, meaning the ability to acknowledge that we're at risk, greatly increases our chances of adhering to some kind of positive health regime. For example, we can know everything about an illness. We can score perfectly on a 100-question test. We can know people who have that illness, however, if we don't think we're vulnerable to that illness, we won't do anything to prevent it from happening. Health psychology researchers have determined that in order to get patients to comply with prevention routines, they must work on perceived vulnerability. And just like building resilience to shame, the critical issue is not about our level of vulnerability, but the level at which we acknowledge our vulnerabilities. From the field of social psychology, influence and persuasion researchers have studied personal vulnerability. These are researchers who examine how people are influenced and persuaded by advertising and marketing. In a very interesting series of studies, researchers found that the participants who thought that they were not susceptible or vulnerable to deceptive advertising were, in fact, the most vulnerable. The researchers explained, "Far from being an effective shield, the illusion of invulnerability undermines the very response that would have supplied genuine protection." Again, this is a very counterintuitive concept because it challenges everything we think about vulnerability. Judith Jordan, a relational cultural theorist from the Stone Center at Wellesley College, points out another difficulty in acknowledging personal vulnerability. Jordan writes, "Acknowledging vulnerability is possible only if we feel we can reach out for support. To do so, we must feel some competence in our relationships. The likelihood of our finding the insight and courage to acknowledge our personal vulnerabilities is dependent on our ability to share and talk about those vulnerabilities with someone we trust and with whom we feel safe. If we don't have people we can trust in our lives, or we have yet to build those kind of relationships, we must reach outside of our existing connection network of friends and family for professional help. Therapists and counselors spend a large part of their practice helping people identify and understand their vulnerabilities, and as a result, they are frequently able to help clients build or identify relationships that can serve as connection networks. For most of us to successfully begin to recognize and understand our shame triggers, we first need to accept that acknowledging our vulnerabilities is an act of courage. We must be mindful in our attempts not to see vulnerability as weakness. I'm very lucky when it comes to this difficult endeavor. My mother taught me a tremendous lesson about vulnerability and courage. In the late 1980s, my mom's only sibling, my uncle Ronnie, was killed in a violent shooting. Just months after his death, my grandmother basically checked out, mentally and emotionally. Having been an alcoholic most of her life, my grandmother didn't have the emotional resources she needed to survive a traumatic loss like this. For weeks, she roamed her neighborhood, randomly asking the same people over and over if they had heard about his death. One day, right after my uncle's memorial service, my mom totally broke down. I had seen her cry once or twice, but I certainly had never seen her cry uncontrollably. My sisters and I were afraid and crying mostly because we were so scared to see her like that. I finally told her that we didn't know what to do because we had never seen her so weak. She looked at us and said in a loving yet forceful voice, "I'm not weak. I'm stronger than you can imagine. I'm just very vulnerable right now. If I were weak, I'd be dead." In that split second, I knew my mom was probably the strongest, most courageous woman I would ever know. She did more than give us permission to use the word vulnerable. She taught us that acknowledging our vulnerability is a true act of ordinary courage. The shame trigger questions. How do we start to recognize our shame triggers? What do we need to do to start acknowledging our vulnerabilities? I think we begin by examining each of the shame categories and trying to unearth the unwanted identities that cause us shame. As I was interviewing both men and women, many of the same phrases kept coming up in the interviews. The ones that I heard over and over were, "I don't want to be seen as," and "I don't want people to think I'm." There were many variations on this, including, "I would die if people thought I was," or, "I can't stand people thinking I'm." As these phrases indicate, shame is about perception. Shame is how we see ourselves through other people's eyes. When I interviewed women about shame experiences, it was always about how others see me or what others think. And often there is even a disconnect between who we want to be and how we want to be perceived. For example, one woman in her 70s told me, "I'm okay when I'm alone. I know I'm changing. I know things are slowing down, and everything is not what it used to be. I just can't stand the thought of others seeing and dismissing me as a person. Being dismissed is shameful." Another good example is body image. We might stand in front of the mirror, naked, thinking, not perfect, but okay. But the moment we think of someone else seeing us, especially someone who is critical, we can just feel the warm wave of shame wash over us. Even if we are totally alone, we rush to cover up. Once we are covered, we fight to push the thought of being exposed out of our mind. That's shame. To help us begin to recognize some of our shame triggers, let's look at the questions I use in my workshop sessions. We start with these fill-in-the-blank statements, which should be answered separately for each of the shame categories. I want to be perceived as blank, blank, and blank. I do not want to be perceived as blank, blank, or blank. These are fairly simple statements. However, when you start to think about these questions in relation to the 12 shame categories, this can be a probing and powerful start to the process. But it's important to remember that it is only a start. As I've said throughout the book, there are no easy answers or quick fixes. The next step is to try to uncover the source of these triggers. When the research participants spoke about their shame triggers, they were able to express an understanding of how and why these triggers developed in their lives. Sylvia's story is a good example of this. The winner-loser dynamic is a shame trigger for Sylvia. The source of this trigger goes back to the enormous pressure she was under from her father when she was a competitive athlete. If we look at our unwanted identities, three questions that can help us start to uncover the sources are: 1. What do these perceptions mean to us? 2. Why are they so unwanted? 3. Where did the messages that fuel these identities come from? When it comes to shame, understanding is a prerequisite for change. We can't consciously make the decision to change our behavior until we are aware of what we are thinking and why we are thinking it. Before she understood the source of her shame, Sylvia actually used the winner-loser framework to shame others. Changing that behavior required her to recognize the power it had in her own life and to understand the source of that power. In the introduction, we met Susan, Kayla, Teresa, and Sandra. Let's take a look at the shame triggers they describe and how these unwanted identities played out in their experiences. Susan was contemplating returning to work until a shaming conversation with her sister. In this exercise, Susan focused on perceptions about motherhood. She wrote, "I want to be perceived as dedicated to my child, putting motherhood before everything else, confident, and easygoing. I do not want to be perceived as selfish, too ambitious, uncaring, or uptight." Susan told me that, after spending some time looking at these, she wasn't the least bit surprised that her sister's comment threw her into shame. "She painted a picture of me that struck my biggest fears. My parents don't believe mothers should work. They attribute the world's problems to the breakdown of the traditional family. I guess now my sister has adopted that belief. If you combine my family's beliefs with the whole working mothers versus stay-at-home mothers mentality, there you have it." After confiding in her boss about becoming a caregiver for her father, Kayla was criticized at work for always being caught in family drama. She wrote how she wants to be perceived at work. "I want to be perceived as competent, strong, dependable, focused, and committed. I don't want to be perceived as scattered, untrustworthy, too emotional, hysterical, or flaky." As Kayla studied what she wrote, she came to an important realization. She said, "When I think about the people I've worked with, who are normally very professional but sometimes act scattered and emotional at work, I'm hard on them. I've never bothered to find out what's going on or why they're having a hard time. My attitude has always been, hey, check your personal crap at the door. We have work to do here. I'm not sure where those messages come from. I guess everywhere. No one likes a slacker, and no one likes the kind of people who bring their personal stuff to work. Both of my parents were in the newspaper business, so they were all business. They also didn't like overly emotional people. I also think it's the very competitive work environment. Women have to work twice as hard. All of these unwanted characteristics get slapped on women all the time. Nancy, my boss, is the worst. She survives in our agency by attacking other women who bring any family stuff to work. Her favorite put-downs are to call someone a drama queen or say, 'Don't get so hysterical.'" Teresa's quest for the perfect body, house, and family resulted in a breakdown, witnessed by her child. She examined her identities as they relate to her family. "I want my family to be perceived as fun-loving, laid-back, organized, happy, and good-looking. I don't want people to think that we are always stressed, falling apart, chaotic, or unhappy." Teresa found it very difficult to talk about her ideal perceptions. She told me, "I can't believe I care about my family being good-looking. That's a horrible thing to care about. It's just, you see these families where everyone is dressed nicely, no one is wrinkled or messy. The moms are pretty, the dads are good-looking, and the kids are super cute. Their houses look like something out of a Pottery Barn catalog. Then you look at yourself and your kids. You wonder how they do it. What are they doing that you don't know about? We're late everywhere we go. By the time I get the last kid dressed, the first one has stuff all over them." I asked her if she knew any family that met her ideals, and after thinking about it, she said, "Yes, my family growing up." She told me that her family was perfect-looking on the outside, and that everyone always complimented her mother on how well-dressed and well-behaved her children were. She told me her mother was very appearance-conscious and was always watching her weight, and dressing to the nines. Teresa started crying as she told me, "There was a price, though. After my mom tucked us in every night, she started drinking. My parents have always had a cold, quiet marriage. She stopped drinking a few years ago, but we don't talk much. We've certainly never talked about this issue." Sandra was able to quickly identify her triggers. She had a notepad in front of her, and she wrote down, I don't want people to see someone who is stupid, always saying the wrong thing, uninformed or uneducated. I want people to see a strong woman who is smart, well-read, knowledgeable, intelligent, well-spoken, and can balance her passion and her knowledge. Sandra explained, The minute my husband told me that I embarrassed him when I talked politics and religion with Dawn, I knew I'd never say another word. He knew how much that would hurt. He went in for the kill. She thought for a minute and said, Maybe I'm just hurting myself by trying to show him, but that's where I am right now. Sandra explained that her parents had raised her to live proud and out loud, but they did not prepare her for the consequences of doing that. She said growing up her teachers shamed her, her minister told her she talked too much and never made sense, her husband was always trying to get her to tone it down, and even her in-laws gave her a hard time for being too excitable and opinionated. As you look at these assessments of their shame triggers, and maybe your own, I want to talk about the issues that always surface when I do this exercise at the workshops. First, we are very hard on ourselves. When we identify these desired and unwanted identities, we give ourselves very little room to be human. Second, we cannot deny the power of the messages we heard growing up. Last, most of us judge others whom we perceive as having the traits we dislike in ourselves. When participants do these exercises in large groups, I often ask how many people found the I want to be perceived questions more difficult to answer, and how many felt the I do not want to be perceived questions more difficult. It's always about 50-50. Those who find the ideal perceptions more difficult to acknowledge often talk about feeling bad for placing so much value on these identities, and sometimes feeling ashamed for even thinking anyone would ever see them this way. For those who find the unwanted identities more difficult to talk about, I often hear that it is painful and scary to look at this list. There's a third set of questions that is very important to this exercise. Examine your list of unwanted identities and ask yourself, if people reduce me to this list, what important and wonderful things will they miss about me? For example, if all Kayla's colleagues see is a coworker who is scattered, untrustworthy, too emotional, and flaky, they'll miss the fact that Kayla is very dedicated to her work, talented, and a committed, loving daughter who is doing the best she can to manage a stressful, painful experience. It's very important that we acknowledge that we are complex, vulnerable people with both strengths and challenges. This is what makes us human and real. Most everyone agrees upon the importance of actually writing down these exercises. I know for me, it is more difficult to write these words out and stare at them on a piece of paper. I also know that it is more meaningful. I can get my head around them. I can be still and reflect. Sometimes we believe that acknowledging our triggers will make them worse. We convince ourselves that if we pretend they don't exist, it's somehow easier. It's not. Our feelings, beliefs, and actions are motivated by these triggers, regardless of whether we write them down and acknowledge them, or we pretend they don't exist. Recognizing and understanding them is the only path to change. In the next section, I'm going to introduce the concept of shame screens. When we don't recognize shame and understand the messages and expectations that trigger our shame, we often rely on our shame screens to protect us. As you'll learn, not only is relying on shame screens ineffective, it can often be shame-inducing in itself. Shame screens. I came up with the term shame screen after analyzing data from the first 100 interviews. As women explained, the unpredictable and sometimes unconscious ways they reacted in response to shame, I realized the experiences shared something in common. When we are in shame, We are often overcome with the need to hide or protect ourselves by any means possible. As I thought about our protective reactions to shame, I kept envisioning smoke screens. The canisters of dense smoke used by the military to hide their activities from the enemy. Unfortunately, shame screens don't work. We're not dealing with tanks and infantry behind enemy lines. We're dealing with people and relationships. Wouldn't it be great if we could just carry those canisters on our belts, and when someone hurt our feelings, shamed us, or made us angry, we could just whip out our canister of thick smoke, launch it, and run? Or we could even just stand there behind the wall of smoke and make rude gestures. Please, I'd order them by the case if I thought they'd work. Unfortunately, we can't do that. The reality is that when we throw up the shame screen, we're usually the ones who end up choking on the smoke. When we experience shame, our first layer of defense often occurs involuntarily. It goes back to our primal flight, fight, and freeze responses. Dr. Shelley Uram, a Harvard-trained psychiatrist, is currently the consulting psychiatrist at The Meadows, a trauma and addiction treatment facility. In her work, Dr. Uram explains that most of us think of traumatic events as big events, like car wrecks and disasters. But Dr. Uram points out that we tend not to recognize the small, quiet traumas that often trigger the same brain survival reaction. After studying Dr. Uram's work, I believe it's possible that many of our early shame experiences, especially with parents and caregivers, were stored in our brains as traumas. This is why we often have such painful bodily reactions when we feel criticized, ridiculed, rejected, and shamed. Dr. Uram explains that the brain does not differentiate between overt or big trauma and covert or small quiet trauma. It just registers the event as a threat that we can't control. In her work on remembering the wound versus becoming the wound, Dr. Uram explains that most of the time when we recall a memory, we are conscious that we are in the present, recalling something from the past. However, when we experience something in the present that triggers an old trauma memory, we re-experience the sense of the original trauma. So, rather than remembering the wound, we become the wound. This makes sense when we think of how we are often returned to a place of smallness and helplessness when we feel shame. After our physical fight, flight, or freeze response, strategies of disconnection provide us with a more complex layer of shame screens. Dr. Linda Hartling, a relational cultural theorist, uses Karen Horney's work on moving toward, moving against, and moving away to outline the strategies of disconnection we use to deal with shame. According to Dr. Hartling, in order to deal with shame, some of us move away by withdrawing, hiding, silencing ourselves, and keeping secrets. Some of us move toward by seeking to appease and please. And some of us move against by trying to gain power over others, being aggressive and using shame to fight shame. During a recent workshop, I was presenting these strategies of disconnection, and they were lettered on my slide A, B, C. A woman raised her hand and asked, "Is there a D for all of the above?" We all laughed. I think most of us are D's. Most of us can relate to all three strategies of disconnection. I know I've used them all, depending on why and how I feel ashamed and who I'm with. I'm less likely to move against when there is a power differential, bosses, doctors, or someone I'm trying to impress, new friends, colleagues. In those situations, I'm more likely to move toward or move away. Unfortunately, I think I reserve moving against for the people with whom I feel the deepest connection, my family members and close friends. This is often where it feels safest to dump our anger and fear. We develop our shame screens over years. Sometimes the way we handle shame has become so deeply ingrained in us that we can't even see it. Other times we'll read books or listen to other people's stories and recognize our own patterns. Either way, it takes much more than reading a book to change how we feel, act, and believe. We can learn and become wiser about who we are and how we behave from reading a book. But we need to put these ideas into practice. We change in and through our relationships with others. Sometimes we can do that with friends and families. Other times we need the support of a therapist or counselor who can walk us through the process. It's a unique and individual journey. How we get there depends on who we are. Another thing to keep in mind is that resilience is not a one-time cure. Don't think that I've spent all this time and energy dissecting my experiences and the payoff is no more shame screens for me. I still use ineffective shame screens. It happens all the time. I'm just much more likely to move through it quicker and with fewer casualties. The next exercise is identifying our shame screens. As you think about each of the shame categories and the triggers associated with each category, try to think of a specific shame experience. How did you respond? Is that a pattern? How do you protect yourself in those situations? Let's take a look at Susan, Kayla, Teresa, Sandra, and Jillian. Susan, I'm definitely someone who moves away or moves toward. I don't like conflict. I don't get aggressive or mean. I just try to make everyone happy. Of course, it never works, and I can get resentful. It will be very difficult to tell my mom and sister that their comments are shaming me. I'm not quite ready, but I think I'll eventually do it. Kayla, there should be one called copycatting. I think I just turn into Nancy and mimic everything she says. It's how I deal with her. If you can't beat them, join them. I just never realized how much it hurts to be on the receiving end. I guess a combination of moving toward and moving against. I suck up when I'm with her. I confide in her when I shouldn't. Then I shame other co-workers for the things she shames me for. That's my shame screen. Teresa, I definitely move toward. I want to please and live up to the expectations. Sandra, I do it all. I shut down, act up, act out, you name it. In this case, I shut down until I started figuring out what was going on. I couldn't set that kind of example for my girls. It's too dangerous. My tendency is to move away, especially with my husband. It's like a form of punishment because I know he'll miss my normal rowdy self. In the next chapter, I'll discuss the importance of reality checking our shame triggers. This helps us build resilience by connecting our own unwanted identities with the larger societal expectations that drive shame. This is essential to developing shame resilience because no matter how alone shame can make us feel, we are all in this together. 4. The second element, practicing critical awareness. A couple of years ago, I was giving a noontime lecture to a large group of medical students, residents, and medical faculty. During these daily lectures, pharmaceutical companies or other sponsors often provide lunch to the attendees. About 20 minutes into my talk on shame and health, I started explaining the concept of critical awareness. Very quickly, I noticed a swelling wave of lost faces. I looked out on the audience, almost all of whom were busy eating, and abruptly asked, "How's the pizza?" Everyone stopped chewing, leaned forward in their chairs, and stared back at me with blank expressions on their faces. I pointed to a long table of empty pizza boxes, and I said, "I'm aware that there were pizzas on that table, and that most of you took a couple of slices on your way to your seat." That's awareness. They looked very unimpressed. Then I said, "I'm also aware that you have very little time for lunch, and the drug company sales rep is offering lunch as an incentive to get you to attend this presentation. If there were no pizza, you probably wouldn't be here. If you weren't here, you wouldn't get to hear me talk. But more importantly, you wouldn't get the pen and the pad that has the drug company's newest logo on it. And patients wouldn't see you carrying that pen, and so on. That's critical awareness." They turned and looked at one another, then looked back at me, and in unison, looked down at their plates. I smiled. Awareness is knowing something exists. Critical awareness is knowing why it exists, how it works, how our society is impacted by it, and who benefits from it. I think they started to get it. The concept of critical awareness is sometimes called critical consciousness or critical perspective. It's the belief that we can increase personal power by understanding the link between our personal experiences and larger social systems. When we look at the shame categories, appearance and body image, motherhood, family, parenting, money and work, mental and physical health, sex, aging, religion, being stereotyped and labeled, speaking out and surviving trauma. Most of us have not been taught how to see the connection between our private lives and social, political, and economic influences. Shame works like the zoom lens on a camera. When we are feeling shame, the camera is zoomed in tight, and all we see is our flawed selves alone and struggling. We think to ourselves, I'm the only one. Something is wrong with me. I am alone. When we zoom out, we start to see a completely different picture. We see many people in the same struggle. Rather than thinking, I'm the only one, we start thinking, I can't believe it, you too? I'm normal. I thought it was just me. Once we start to see the big picture, we are better able to reality check our shame triggers and the social community expectations that fuel shame. I think the best way to learn critical awareness is to apply the concepts to a real issue. Let's start by looking at the issue of appearance and body image. I like to use this issue as an example because it is an almost universal shame trigger. To begin to understand the big picture, we need to ask the following big picture questions about appearance. What are the social community expectations around appearance? Why do these expectations exist? How do these expectations work? How is our society influenced by these expectations? Who benefits from these expectations? While each of us would probably have specific answers to these questions based on our age, race, ethnicity, etc., for the purpose of the example, I'm going to respond with broad general answers. First, what are the social community expectations of appearance? From a societal level, appearance includes everything from hair, skin, makeup, weight, clothing, shoes, and nails to attitude, confidence, age, and wealth. If you pile on community-specific expectations, you might have to add things like hair texture, hair length, skin color, face and body hair, teeth, looking done up, not looking done up, clothing, and jewelry. Why do appearance expectations exist? I would say they exist to keep us spending our valuable resources, money, time, and energy, on trying to meet some ideal that is not achievable. Think about this. Americans spend more each year on beauty than we do on education. How does it work? I think the expectations are both obvious and subtle. They are everything we see and everything we don't see. If you read fashion magazines or watch TV, you know what you are supposed to look like and how you are supposed to dress and act. If you look hard enough, you also see everything that's missing, the images of real people. If you combine what's there with what's missing, you quickly come to believe that if you don't look a certain way, you become invisible, you don't matter. What is the impact of these expectations? Well, let's see. About 80 million Americans are obese. Approximately 7 million girls and women suffer from an eating disorder. Up to 19% of college-aged women are bulimic. Eating disorders are the third most common chronic illness among females. The latest surveys show very young girls are going on diets because they think they are fat and unattractive. In one American survey, 81% of 10-year-old girls had already dieted at least once. A research survey found that the single largest group of high school students considering or attempting suicide are girls who feel they are overweight. 25 years ago, top models and beauty queens weighed only 8% less than the average woman. Now they weigh 23% less. The current media ideal for women is achievable by less than 5% of the female population, and that's just in terms of weight and size. Among women over 18, looking at themselves in the mirror, research indicates that at least 80% are unhappy with what they see. Many will not even be seeing an accurate reflection. Most of us have heard that people with anorexia see themselves as larger than they really are, but some recent research indicates that this kind of distorted body image is by no means confined to those suffering from eating disorders. In some studies, up to 80% of women overestimated their size. Increasing numbers of women with no weight problems or clinical psychological disorders look at themselves in the mirror and see ugliness and fat. According to the American Society for Aesthetic Plastic Surgery, since 1997, there has been a 465% increase in the total number of cosmetic procedures. Women had nearly 10.7 million cosmetic procedures, 90% of the total. The number of cosmetic procedures for women has increased 49% since 2003. The top five surgical procedures for women were liposuction, breast augmentation, eyelid surgery, tummy tuck, and facelift. Americans spent just under $12.5 billion on cosmetic procedures in 2004. Who benefits from the appearance expectations? The $38 billion hair industry. The $33 billion diet industry. The $24 billion skincare industry, the $18 billion makeup industry, the $15 billion perfume industry, the $13 billion cosmetic surgery industry. That's a whole bunch of folks depending on us to see and believe messages that sell the social community expectations of appearance. If we don't believe we're too fat, ugly, and old, then they don't sell their products. If they don't sell their products, they don't make their house payments. The pressure is on. When we ask and answer these big picture questions, we begin to develop critical awareness. The next step is learning how to use this information to reality check our shame triggers. We do that by looking at our shame triggers and asking these six reality check questions. How realistic are my expectations? Can I be all these things all of the time? Do the expectations conflict with each other? Am I describing who I want to be or who others want me to be? If someone perceives me as having these unwanted identities, what will happen? Can I control how others perceive me? How do I try? During our second interview, Jillian shared her answers to these reality check questions with me. Jillian's ideal identities are thin, sexy, confident, natural, and young. Her unwanted identities are middle-aged, tired, fat, and frumpy. Here's how she answered these questions. How realistic are my expectations? Not realistic at all. I am middle-aged, and I'm tired a lot. I don't always look tired, but you can't change my age. The truth is that I'm not going to look thin and sexy all the time. When I first started this process, I thought it was realistic. But the more I learn about the expectations I put on myself and the images I measure myself against, the more I realize that I literally can't have that. The girls in these magazines are 16, or maybe 20 at the oldest. I might be able to feel sexy and fit, but I won't look it by the movie standards. The truth is that it's not okay to look 40. It's okay to be 40 as long as you look like you're 25 or 30. I saw a commercial the other day where the model said, "I don't mind being my age, I just don't want to look it." Why not? If she said, "Hey America, this is what 40 looks like," then we'd all want to look our age. Can I be all these things all of the time? No, I can't. I do look good sometimes. I'm proud of how I look every now and then, but I'm still hard on myself because I don't look great all the time. I'll be at home with my gown and slippers on and my hair pulled back and think, what a slob. Even then, I think I should have on Victoria's Secret lingerie. I'm starting to hate the television. Do the expectations conflict with each other?
Yes.
This was the most eye-opening question for me. I can't look confident when I am afraid that people will think I'm fat and frumpy. And I don't look so natural.